Everybody, and welcome to today's internet seminar, Pore Water Concentrations and Bioavailability, How You Can Measure Them, and Why They Influence Contaminated Sediment Remediation. This is our second session, and it's entitled Passive Sampling Devices for Organic Contaminants. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, the Superfund Research Program, and by NARPM Presents. It was recently held as a course at the 2014 National Association for Remedial Project Managers training meeting. My name is Matt Lambert. I'm an environmental scientist at EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. I'm in the science policy branch, and I'll be your moderator for today. We're going to get started in just a few minutes here. While we're waiting for folks to log on, we'll just go over some of the housekeeping details for today. When you were registered, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is on the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of the session and some bio sketches of the instructors and their pictures. Please note the presenters' email addresses are included on that page in case, after today's session is completed, you have any additional questions for them. For those of you joining us, being the limited number of phone lines, your phone lines were automatically put on mute when you joined the call. When requested, or we request that you keep your phone on mute for the whole seminar, we have allotted several different times for question and answers. And at that point, you're welcome to take your phone off of mute and ask your question. You simply do this by pressing #6 to unmute the phone. Once you've asked your question, please go ahead and put your phone back on mute by pressing *6. So again, that's #6 to unmute, *6 to mute. This should greatly help us reduce some of the background noises that can disrupt the quality of our transmission. Also, many organizations have a hold option, and those hold options have music or advertisements, and that can be really disruptive to the call. So please do not put us on hold. So again, stay on mute, and please do not put us on hold.
Hey, Matt, this is Justin. Sorry to interrupt. There have already been a couple comments that people can barely hear you. You're coming through fine for me, so I would encourage everyone to make sure that they have their speaker volume turned up. Sometimes that may be the volume on your actual speakers themselves, and sometimes that may be the volume on your computer. So make sure both of those are turned up, and we will do our best to speak directly into the phone. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Justin, and I will keep the microphone as close as I can and speak up a little bit. By now, hopefully everyone has joined the Adobe Connect meeting room. You should see a number of windows or pods within that room, and that should include the presentation materials. So slide number one should be visible now. And as I go over the housekeeping slides, you'll see us go through them. If you have any trouble viewing these slides, you can click the full screen option in the upper right-hand corner of your shared window to expand that. And also, if you have other technical difficulties with Adobe Connect, our webinar site, you should have the downloadable portions of the presentation, so you can follow along manually. So I'm not sure if all of those portions are available, but some of them should be already posted there. The majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. If you do have problems with the audio, and it sounds like at least we had some volume problems already, go ahead and check your own speakers and headphones. And if you're on the phone lines, you may need to turn those speakers off to avoid feedback. You can submit questions by using the Q&A pod that you'll see in the lower right-hand corner of your screen. You do not need to wait until a Q&A period to submit questions through that Q&A pod. In fact, it's easier for us to go ahead and add your questions anytime in advance of the Q&A session. Please note these questions will only be visible to the host. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. At the appropriate time for the Q&A, I will read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters, for as many as we have time for. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to the technical difficulties that you're encountering. Please include a telephone number where you can be reached, and we'll try and help you troubleshoot through that problem. You may also contact our technical support directly, and the phone number there is 301 589 501-589-5318. Again, that number is 301-589-5318. So, as stated earlier, we'll have a Q&A session after each section of the webinar and a general Q&A at the end. Also, after the presentations, we're going to walk through the related URLs pod, and there's a whole bunch of information related to today's topic for you there. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation is over. And also, we will typically place these seminars into an archive with the associated soundtrack, so anytime in the future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Additionally, you'll receive an automatically receive an email once that archive is available. Associated with the related URLs pod is an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online form to give us some feedback on today's webinar. We do look at the comments, and we try to improve our content and our delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback as a record of your participation in today's event. And with that, I think we're ready to start this session. So just a final reminder, please do put us on mute and not put us on hold. This webinar series has been a joint venture between NIEHS Superfund Research Program and the Superfund Program's Contaminated Sediments Forum. I'd like to thank Heather Henry at NIEHS for all of the hard work she's done in pulling this webinar together and in developing the original course. She is the one who made this webinar series happen, so thank you, Heather. Also, in addition to the instructors who have put a lot of time and effort into developing the course, there are many other folks who helped us out, including the Sediment Forum co-chairs, the NARPM co-chairs, and all the folks with the CLUIN staff, so thank you to you all. Now, our first presenter today is Dr. Keith Maruya. Dr. Maruya is an environmental scientist who specializes in the analysis, fate, and effects of trace contaminants in aquatic systems. He attained his BS in 1983 and his MS in 1986 in chemical and environmental engineering from the University of Southern California, and his PhD in environmental engineering science in 1995 from the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Maruya joined SCCWRP, or SCWRP, in 2005, and currently directs research that focuses on relevant cost-effective measurements of organic contaminants and how to prioritize unregulated chemicals for future monitoring, assessment, and research. With that, Dr. Maruya, the stage is yours.
Thank you, Matt, and also thanks to Heather. I hope I correctly unmuted myself. Am I audible to everybody, Justin, Matt?
Yes, you are.
Okay, great. So again, thanks for the introduction. Thank you to everybody for participating. And my job in this training course is really just to set the stage and to describe really the convening of a technical workshop that we put together a couple of years ago, really to get a group of folks to reach consensus on how we can apply passive sampling methods and in what applications are these methods best suited for. So with that, I'm going to provide a little background on why we need PSMs, why they're so important to move forward with this. In terms of contaminated sediment assessment, we usually rely on multiple lines of evidence to grade sediment. Oh. Is there a comment? Okay, I'll continue. And in these multiple lines of evidence, there's usually a metric of chemical exposure. And the chemical exposure metric historically that we relied on is really the total amount of...
Hey, Keith, excuse me.
Yes.
I apologize for interrupting. This is Justin. I would just like to, in fact, I'm not going to remind everybody, but I'm going to go ahead and put everyone on mute once again. So the presenters are going to need to press #6 to unmute their phones. I believe we're just getting some feedback from some phones that are unmuted. So I'm going to go ahead and mute everyone, and you'll need to press #6 once again to unmute your phone.
All right. Okay, back online. What you're looking at in this slide is, oh, go ahead, Justin, do you need?
No, I was just saying great, thank you very much.
Okay. Is a plot of the different multiple lines of evidence that we use in contaminant assessment. On the x-axis is what we call our bulk or total concentration of a contaminant stressor, in this case lead. And on the y-axis you're seeing our parameters of interest, whether it's a toxicity parameter like percent mortality that we assess in the lab on contaminated sediment aliquots, or even in situ indices of benthic condition, and that's what we're showing in the hot pink. The benthic response index is a measure of in situ condition. And you can see for lead, we can see somewhat a relationship between increasing levels of lead and degraded conditions, whether it's measured by toxicity or in situ condition. We see a spread of about two orders of magnitude, though, in that bulk sediment parameter. So it's somewhat predictive, but not really that great. When we go to something like high molecular weight PAHs, which you're seeing in this slide along the x-axis, you can see that spread that is now generated over several orders of magnitude. When we're faced with this situation, we can see very clearly that bulk or total sediment concentrations are really not very useful in determining the quality of a given sediment. So the impetus for alternative measures of exposure are that the bulk concentration, where it can be used as a screening level indicator in some cases, in some simple cases, by and large leads to a lot of perhaps misleading conclusions and large uncertainty in getting us where we need to go with assessing the quality of a sediment. About 20 years ago, though, some clever scientists and engineers developed what we call equilibrium partitioning models. These models take sediment assessment to the next level, where we're actually looking at aqueous concentrations of our contaminant of interest in the sediment interstitial or pore water. This was a big leap forward in that now we're assessing the phase, in other words, the pore water phase, that we think is the most relevant for exposure to certainly benthic organisms that are living in the sediment. These models assume a given interaction with a controlling phase. In the case of organics, that would be the sediment organic carbon phase, and for metals, that would be the sulfidic component in surface sediments. Again, a great leap forward, but what happens with equilibrium partition is you assume a generic form of that controlling phase. For organics, we're talking about sediment organic carbon. In reality, we now know that there are many different types of organic carbon out there. Urban soot or carbon soot is one form that we're very familiar with now that creates a different partitioning environment for these hydrophobic organics of importance. So that gets us to how passive samplers and passive sampling methodology can help us. Again, there are, over the past 15 years since equilibrium partitioning was first proposed, passive samplers have been sprinkled throughout the literature during that period. And a couple years ago, a group of scientists and regulators decided now was the time to bring the group together and provide some consensus guidance on how passive samplers could be used for contaminated sediment management. This culminated in a workshop of about 50 participants and is equally divided between academic researchers, government regulators, and also practitioners, including consultants and, let's say, passive sampler developers who would help commercialize and make these techniques more widely available. We held that workshop here at my facility in Southern California, and this workshop resulted in the production of a series of articles that are now published in Integrated Environmental Assessment and Management. So, digging a little deeper into the types of passive samplers that are available, really the early on the steering committee decided to distinguish between two general classes of samplers. One that sense the freely dissolved concentration of a given contaminant in the pore water, and the second method being more of a total sink assessment that desorbs from a given pool sediment, and that's what we refer to as a desorption-based method. These two types of methods are both useful in their own way. They do measure different metrics, again, the C-free for the chemical activity and a mass or fractional desorption resulting from the second method. For the workshop, we did not feel like we could give both methods their due. We felt that the C-free method was more easily relatable with theory and to mechanisms of contaminant distribution and uptake. And for that reason, we focused the workshop on the methods that give us the C-free metric. That is, again, not to say that the desorption methods are not useful in this sense, but we basically left that topic open for a future workshop and group. So some of the contaminants that we, of course, are interested in, most of these are stated in regulatory action at sites of interest. We have polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. We have a series of legacy organochlorines, PCBs, some of the pesticides like DDTs and chlorines. These are all hydrophobic compounds that we know persist in sediments and cause issues with either toxicity or bioaccumulation at our contaminated assessment sites. So most of the workshop and most of the applications will focus on these types of organic contaminants. Passive samplers come in many shapes of many different materials and in configurations. And this slide is just to show some of the variety of passive samplers that are out there. On the left, you see the acronym SPEMI. This is a fiber form of passive sampler. Those fibers are actually coated with a thin film of silicone material, similar to what we use to coat the inner surfaces of GC columns. So it's a sorptive phase that will take up and release organic contaminants. In the middle, we have PE or polyethylene. These are very simply just thin sheets of plastic that we can get right off the shelf of your local hardware store. On the right, we have a different sheet that's called POM. It's a polyoxymethylene polymer. A little thicker material, a little more rigid, but again, the basic principle of these polymers are all the same. They take up the organic contaminant of interest from the aqueous phase, they store it in the polymer phase, and then when we get back to the lab, we can either desorb or extract off the residual contamination and analyze that using our instrumental techniques. These passive samplers can be operated in really two different ways. In a short period, we refer to a kinetic phase where we haven't reached full equilibrium, but we need to understand how rapid that uptake is to calibrate this type of passive sampler in this mode. So really, you need two types of parameters to accurately estimate the C-free concentration. The preferred mode, though, is to really use these passive samplers in what we call the equilibrium mode. And the reason for this is really twofold. we only need a single parameter now, and you see the KPW to estimate the this freely dissolved concentration. The CP we measure using the passive sampler. So a single parameter estimation simplifies the calculation process. And also, at equilibrium mode, you're really realizing the full detectability potential of the polymer. In other words, you've got the most largest mass of contaminant in your polymer at that time, which in theory gives you better sensitivity for sampling. So for those two reasons, equilibrium mode is a preferred mode for to operate these samplers. In the past, we have used passive samplers both in the lab and in situ. In the lab, we take sediment aliquots, we bring them back to the lab, and we can accelerate the equilibrium achieved with a small volume of sediment with our passive sampler. It really gives us what we think is a worst-case estimate of that C-free. In other words, we maximize the amount of contaminant that we can sense in the aqueous veins. Yeah. When we go to the field conditions now, we cannot control the conditions in the field. It may be more relevant, but we run into things, issues such as longer deployment times, months perhaps. We then worry about things like fouling, damage, even vandalism comes into play if samplers are left out for extended periods of time. Clearly, we think that lab-based measurements are more controllable and likely quicker and cheaper. But again, the actual application, whether you select field or lab, really depends on your measurement goals. Here's just some pictures of how we adapt the different samplers for those different applications. On the right, you see a simple housing for a steamy fiber that's put it in a glass aquaria for a lab exposure. And on the bottom, you see a very crude fixture that we can put in intertidal areas to submerge such samplers below the sediment water interface. One of the good things about passive samplers is that the technology can be very simple and low cost in terms of deployment. Where it gets a little more complicated, though, is when you go to deeper subtidal environments and remote a deployment and retrieval becomes very difficult. The bottom line for the passive samplers that we've learned over the years of research is that it does get us a better predictor. It is a much better predictor of the parameters that we care about in terms of toxicity and also by accumulation. So it greatly improves, as you can see by these relationships, the spread that we saw earlier with C-bulk now is somewhat much more manageable when we consider C-free as our exposure metric. That is not to say, though, that we have everything figured out. Obviously, there are challenges that still remain in applying passive samplers. A few of those challenges are listed here. The K values that I mentioned in the equilibrium estimation is a very key parameter. Obviously, if you have large uncertainty and non-consensus among which K-values to use, that will create issues. Part of the workshop, again, was to bring those that generate these K-parameters to reach some consensus on what parameters are actually believable and should be used. The other challenge is we've had a few intercalibration studies where different labs use the same methods or even different methods, but we need to plan and conduct more of these intercalibration studies so we know what the lab intervariability and method intervariability really is. And perhaps one of the greatest challenges for particularly in situ applications is what do we do when we have non-equilibrium, which for very hydrophobic compounds can occur quite frequently. The research tells us we can use reference compounds that are preloaded into these passive samplers, but understanding their behavior and developing relationships to correct for non-equilibrium still needs to be pinned down. From the regulatory standpoint, again, the workshop was conducted to be interdisciplinary and interactive. The scientists clearly need to translate how passive samplers work, what the uncertainty with C-free measurements are, especially compared to the status quo. We think uncertainty certainly is within an order of magnitude, where, as you saw before, uncertainties with C-bulk were span several orders of magnitude. So we're clearly in a better state, but we need to refine what our uncertainties really are. And lastly, how we can use C-free in site assessment models when before we're using C-bulk and perhaps other parameters. Issues of cost, issues of widespread availability still remain, but as we work together, we can break down some of these practical and regulatory barriers. And again, the focus of our workshop was to do exactly that. I mentioned the six papers that came out of this workshop. A single paper headed up by Philip Meyer as the lead author described the theoretical basis for PSM. So I encourage everybody to look through these articles and see where we took addressed each of these issues. Upal Ghosh, who will be speaking later, headed up the second paper, which provided practical guidance on actually selecting among the different passive samplers available for a particular application, and also how to standardize these passive samplers before you apply them. The last paper that I'll point out is headed up by Mark Greenberg. I think Mark either spoke at a previous seminar or maybe the last one, but this is taking the passive sampler and put it into that decision-making framework or context, how they can be used, how they can be incorporated into the existing framework. With that, I will just thank our steering committee, a great group of folks who helped guide our effort and to disseminate the results of that workshop into the papers and also through seminars like this. Most of all, the workshop participants were, again, a great group to work with, and without them, such consensus guidance could not be possible. So with that, I will end, and I'm happy to entertain any questions.
So this is Matt. Thank you, Keith. And we do have time for some questions. For those folks who are on the phone lines, we'll start with you. If you'd like to ask a question, please press #6, state your name and your organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Just remember to remute your phone by pressing *6.
This is Ken Finkelstein with NOAA. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I can, Ken.
Okay. I'm a little bit perplexed by the C-free, because when I have used this, I come up with a KOC about 7.5. And when I use some of the literature values, you know, the KOW to KOC transformations, I come up with 4.8 for the same data set. And that's three orders of magnitude difference. And when I try to calculate out a certain injury, a percent injury using one method versus the other, I'm sorry, one KOC versus the other KOC, I'm 500 to 1,000 times different. In one respect, you may say the injury value for PCBs in this case is too low, but the other one is so high that it makes no sense at all. And I was wondering if you could discuss the concentration free a little bit more and how it actually affects the injury to benthic organisms and the fish utilizing those waters.
Okay, so let me start by giving my take on C-free. C-free is what we refer to as the freely dissolved concentration. In the aqueous phase, you can have a contaminant such as a PCB in the freely dissolved state, you can have it complex to dissolved or colloidal organic matter, and you can also have the compound sort to very fine particles, what we call total suspended solids, let's say. The C total in the water will be the sum of all of those. So the C free will be a subset, obviously, of all of those components. The passive samplers are geared toward measuring only the C free, not the amount that's sorbed to colloidal, and certainly not the amount that's sorbed to fine particles. That's the benefit that we see with passive samplers. When you say that you estimated a KOC of 4.8, I would suspect that many of those other phases are contributing to that. And so the actual concentration or the freely dissolved concentration, again, depending on your compound,
absolutely right about that. That's absolutely correct.
Yeah. So does that help? Does that answer your question?
No, it doesn't, because let's just say the fish or the invertebrate is living in an environment that has colloids in the water column, and it's being exposed to these colloids, whereas the free is not, and the difference in the KOC is so large that you can't use one or the other. There's no middle ground, and so it seems that both of them reach a point of somewhat absurdity, possibly. I mean, like, we don't have a method for this to come up with a value that will allow us to come up with what's a safe concentration for a fish or an invertebrate. I'm usually using the invertebrates, but it's true for the fish as well.
I will defer to Rob Burgess. Rob has actually put together a construct using the C-free metric in an existing framework where you can come up with chronic values. Okay, I think these are obviously reference values for a given compound, but it is based on C-free. And yes, it is problematic when you see a wide variation of estimated, you're talking estimated based on KOW. I would say that we are refining that estimate by using the PSM-derived C-free, whereas the KOW-derived value, again, is a very, very rough estimate. I appreciate your recognition of the orders of magnitude difference that may result. Again, the C-free is not meant to be directly translated as a hazard quotient. It is a proxy for exposure and potential for toxic effects and bioaccumulation. It's not
I think we're going to come back to this with both of our other speakers too. So, Ken, if we don't answer the question by the end of today, ask it again, and we'll come back to this. A bunch of questions here online, and I think in the interest of time, we'll move to the next speaker, and we'll try and get those questions asked at the next Q&A or at the final Q&A.
And I apologize for those other people wanting to ask questions. I'm sorry. It took that long.
No problem.
Again, thank you, Dr. Maria, and we'll move on to our second presentation today. So today's second presentation is from Dr. Rob Burgess. Rob is a research physical scientist employed at the EPA's Office of Research and Development, Atlantic Ecology Division in Narragansett, Rhode Island. Dr. Burgess has been with the EPA for about 20 years, and his current research focuses on better understanding the partitioning and bioavailability of organic and metal contaminants in the environment. Specifically, this research is looking at the use of passive samplers to measure the bioavailability of legacy and emerging contaminants, including nanomaterials in the marine environment. He's participated in several review committees, both on the national and international level, as well as several scientific workshops. Dr. Burgess is an active member of the Society of Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry, the American Chemical Society, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He's contributed to the authorship of approximately 100 peer-reviewed papers and book chapters, most of which are related to geochemistry, sediment contamination, and aspects of ecological risk assessment. Dr. Burgess received a master's degree in biological oceanography and a PhD in chemical oceanography from the University of Rhode Island Graduate School of Oceanography. Dr. Burgess, it's all yours.
Okay, thanks, Matt. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, great. And I'm thinking maybe we can get back to Ken's question at the end. All right. Just an outline of what I'll be talking about for the next few minutes. Why we use passive sampling methods and what they tell us, the types of passive samplers and how they work, preparing, deploying, recovering, and the storage of passive samplers, and then very briefly the analysis of passive sampler data, and then a summary. And some of this will overlap with what Keith just presented, but maybe in a little bit more detail. And just to reiterate the point that we're talking about nonpolar, non-ionic organic contaminants today, not metals. All right, so passive samplers basically tell us two things, at least two things. The first is the dissolved concentration of contaminants of concern, Keith was referring to as the C-free. Something that's very valuable about this value is that it has been shown to correlate fairly well with the bioavailable concentration of contaminants, of non-ionic contaminants. And this is true in pore waters, or what we could call interstitial waters, as well as the water column. And what's really useful about that value, that C-free value, is we can compare it to any other water-only toxicity value, water quality criteria, other water quality standards, and determine if we've exceeded some sort of threshold. So that's one thing. Second thing is just simply the concentration of organic contaminants in the passive sampler. Over the last, say, 5 years, there's been a pretty good data set put together that shows a good correlation between what accumulates in a passive sampler and what's bioaccumulated by certain organisms, things like mussels and polychaetes in sediment exposures. So you could see in some circumstances that we could use passive samplers as surrogates for bioaccumulating organisms if we needed to. And this could be true of water column animals as well as benthic organisms. And you know, a situation where this might come in handy is, well, really two. If you can't find animals to deploy at a given time because they're just seasonally not available, or if you have a system that is so toxic or has low DO or has high temperatures or low temperatures, ice, and you simply can't deploy the animals, you might want to use passive samplers. Okay, so let's just take a look at a section of the environment for a second. We have our atmosphere. We have our water, we have our contaminated sediments, and let's just take a closer look at what's going on in those contaminated sediments. We have our sediment particles, we have our pore water, we have our PCB molecules in this case, and those are those yellow things that are attached or associated to the particulate phases, and we have our freely dissolved, our dissolved and bioavailable concentration, the C-free that we've been talking about. And this is really, for today's discussion, what we want to try and get at with our passive samplers. Because we know over time, those C-free compounds, contaminants, will make their way through advection and diffusion out of the sediments. They'll accumulate in the benthos. They'll accumulate in fish. They'll accumulate in mussels, that is shellfish, and eventually may get into the human food chain or food web. So one thing I want to do is just focus for a second on what's going on in those sediments. So let's just kind of blow things up a bit here. So again, we have our sediment particles, we have our pore water, we have our PCBs associated with the sediment particles, and we have our free PCBs. Now, in a system that is approaching equilibrium or is at equilibrium, and we tend to assume at contaminated sites we have those conditions for most of the times, maybe not all the times, but most of the times we're approaching equilibrium, we have equilibrium partitioning, and we have partition coefficients. And I want to now just talk for a bit about how these partition coefficients relate back to our passive samplers. So one partition coefficient we use quite a bit is the KD, the distribution coefficient. And that's simply the concentration of the contaminant on the sediment divided by the C-free concentration. If we normalize the distribution coefficient, the KD, by the organic carbon content of the sediment, and we know that a lot of the contaminants associate with the organic carbon as well as the black carbon, but for today's discussion we'll just focus on the organic carbon, we can get the KOC, the organic carbon normalized partition coefficient that Ken was just talking about. Now, another process that we have going on in these sediments under equilibrium conditions, as I just showed, is we do have the diffusion of contaminants out of the sediments over time, via the pore water, into the water column or into another system. And what happens is when that contaminant diffuses out, it is then replaced in the pore water by contaminants from the solid phase. So the solid phase basically acts as a source of contaminants to maintain that equilibrium condition in the pore water that we're trying to get at with our passive samplers, trying to measure with our passive samplers. So it's a diffusion with replacement to maintain equilibrium. Now, if we stick an organism in here, this big nasty-looking polychaete, over time, it's going to accumulate contaminants, bioaccumulate them, and the contaminants will get replaced back into the pore water from the solid phase. And we can generate a bioconcentration factor, the concentration in the biota divided by the concentration in the C-free. Now, if we insert a passive sampler into this system, and this is my passive sampler, it looks like an eraser or something out of 2001, A Space Odyssey, but it really is a passive sampler for this particular presentation, it behaves just like an organism. It accumulates the contaminants, and then to maintain equilibrium, the contaminants then partition into the interstitial water to maintain those equilibrium conditions. And finally, we can generate the K value that Keith was talking about, the sampler partition coefficient, as the concentration in the sampler divided by the C-free concentration. And we'll talk about that more in a little bit. So if we get out of the sediments and think about what is your, let me put this up here on the screen. For your average contaminated sediment, how does the pore water C-free behave? And one way to look at this is we have dissolved concentration, the C-free on the y-axis, nanograms per liter. On the x-axis, we have time in days. Basically, that'd be our deployment time for a sampler. And if we look at the actual C-free concentration, and we really don't have the technology to get at this in real time at this point, or it'd be very expensive to do it, but this is what it might look like, or probably looks like, under equilibrium conditions, or approaching equilibrium conditions. And we may have this dip that you see right in the middle of the screen, and that might be when we had a resuspension event where overlying water was infused into the pore water and thus reduced the concentration of the PCBs temporarily. The PCB concentration then rebounds back to its equilibrium or steady state condition. When we put our passive sampler into the system, and we do this for days or weeks in order to make sure we come to equilibrium, as Keith was talking about earlier, eventually we reach a time-averaged or time-integrated measurement that approximates what the actual pore water concentration is for these sediments. Okay, so if we go back to our environment, our section of the aquatic environment here, again, the focus is on what's going on in the benthos and trying to get at the C-free concentration there. But now we're going to use passive samplers to get at that C-free concentration, again, with a focus on what's going on in the benthos using passive samplers we can put into the sediments. And I'll show you some of those in a little bit. Okay, so to get away from the conceptual stuff now, we'll get into the actual passive samplers that are most commonly used in North America. And there's really four of them, and Keith went through these as well, but just to give you some more photographs of them. We have polyethylene, which is just a very common plastic, and you can buy this, as Keith said, at the hardware store. We use the plastic that you'd put down on the floor if you're painting a room to keep paint off your rug or off your wood flooring. Thickness is the key with passive samplers. The thinner they are, the more rapidly they achieve equilibrium, or the contaminant achieves equilibrium. Right now, PE can be purchased at a thickness of about 25 to 50 microns thick. A second type of passive sampler is polyoxymethylene POM. This is a more dense material, similar to the acetates we used to use to do overhead slide projections before PowerPoint came along. And you can purchase that material right now commercially with a thickness of 75 microns. Next one is SPEME, and this one, as Keith mentioned, is a little more complicated to describe. It's actually fiber optic cable. There is a glass core in the center, and it is surrounded by this insulating material, what's PDMS, polydimethyl siloxane, that insulates that glass core, but it also happens to have a very high affinity for organic contaminants. And the thickness of that PDMS can be 10 to 100 microns. The last one is the semi-permeable membrane device, the SPMD that you may have heard of. This is actually also made of polyethylene, but it's a polyethylene tube that has had triolein, a synthetic lipid material, injected inside, and then the tube is heat sealed on each end to keep the triolein inside. And this can vary in length because it's a tube, so you can cut it to whatever length you want. Thicknesses vary from about 50 to 95 microns. The thing is with SPMDs, though, we really don't use them in the sediments that often, because they may rip open. And once they rip open and triolein comes out, it makes it very complicated to interpret the data. So really, we're down to the first three passive samplers. Very quickly, this slide got kind of messed up, but very quickly, I just wanted to show you the structures of these passive samplers, these polymers, just to explain why they function, why they have an affinity for these organic contaminants. And as you can see on the left-hand side, these are all hydrocarbons. PE is all carbon and hydrogen. The POM and the PDMS have oxygens and silicones, but they are primarily hydrocarbons. And if we bring in a PCB molecule, it's kind of a portly PCB, except for the green, which is the chlorine atoms, the rest of the molecule is also hydrocarbon. It's carbons and hydrogens. And it leads us to that old chemistry adage that like dissolves like. The contaminant actually dissolves into the polymer because they have a high affinity for one another, whereas the PCB, in this case, or the contaminant, doesn't have very much affinity for the water molecules that it's trying to squeeze into in pore water or in the water column. Okay, some cartoons here just to show you how these things work, at least conceptually. So we have a section of pore water here. We have some PCB molecules dissolved in that pore water in the C-free form. We put back our eraser-looking passive sampler, and this could be PE or POM or SPEME. It's a very clean. Passive sampler has been cleaned to be as lacking in contamination as possible. And then as soon as you put the passive sampler into the system, it starts to accumulate the contaminants. And another way we can look at this is like this. We have on the y-axis, we have the nanograms per gram of contaminant in the passive sampler. We have deployment time on the x-axis. And hopefully you can see that as time goes by in that same passive sampler, the concentration of the PCBs increases. We can convert this over to a uptake curve like this. And at some point, some magic moment, we reach equilibrium where contaminant is no longer, or the amount of contaminant going into the sampler is equivalent to the amount of contaminant leaving the sampler, and so we're at equilibrium. Now, once we can do this, and Keith emphasized this as well, this is when we can calculate the C-free concentration using this relatively simple equation. So we have C-free, and we have the concentration in the sampler, that's in the numerator, and then we have our, and then we also have our partition coefficient in the denominator. And I think Upal will talk about the partition coefficients in more detail in his presentation. And the key here is that this is all equilibrium sampling. We have to be at equilibrium before we can invoke this equation to calculate our C-free. Real quickly, I just wanted to go through the preparation, deployment, recovery of passive sampling and storage. So starting up in the upper left-hand corner, we just start with our passive sampler. This happens to be a piece of PE. We clean it. That takes 24 to 48 hours, depending on how thorough you are. You do your deployment, and on average, they will last, and this is in the field, I should say, about 30 days in the field. In the laboratory, it might be shorter. You do your recovery. You take your samplers back to the laboratory, and then you freeze them at negative 4 degrees C in aluminum foil or some sort of foil to protect them. And you can stop there. You can wait until you're ready to do the extractions, do your chemical analyses. The samplers and the contaminants will stay fine in frozen conditions. And this upper layer, this upper level, is really the unique part of the passive sampling. What we're going to talk about next, you would have to do with any type of sample, a sediment sample, a water sample, a tissue sample. So next is to do the actual solvent extraction with a passive sampler. It takes about 48 hours. Volume reduction takes about an hour a sample, but of course you're doing multiple samples at a time. And then you do your mass spec analysis to actually measure the contaminants. Next, I wanted to go through some more photographs of what these samplers look like in action, starting with some water column deployments. At our laboratory in Narragansett, this is shown on the left-hand side, we do a lot of comparison of passive samplers to see how they perform. So using these minnow traps, we put passive samplers in there. We have PE, we have POM. We also have some SPEMI, and because the SPEMI fiber is very small, you usually put them in some sort of protective casing or covering. In this case, we put them into a copper mesh envelope, and that's how we deploy them. On the right-hand side, we have a system that was developed at MIT by Phil Geschwind and his group, and that simply has the PE on a stainless steel ring, and that's deployed in the water column. The circles just highlight the SPEMI fibers. And here are some cartoons showing you what these would look like in actual deployment, including the image on the right-hand side, which is the system that Keith has developed. We'll take a closer look at that right now. So these are for pore water deployments, but some of them can be used in the water column as well, as I just showed. This system that Keith developed involves SPEMI that are attached to a syringe. They're then put inside these copper tubes to protect them, and they can be inserted into the sediment or deployed in the water column like I showed. In the middle frame, we have a system that's very similar that also uses SPEMI. This was developed by a colleague in Denmark. And then finally, on the right-hand side, we have a system that Danny Reibel at Texas Tech developed, where he has this stainless steel rod that you put a piece of SPEMI fiber in vertically, and you can stick that into the sediment. And I don't know if you can see it, but down in the lower right-hand corner, there's a photograph of that SPEMI fiber. Another system, this was developed at MIT, you take the either POM or PE, put it between two pieces of metal, aluminum, or stainless steel, bolt them together, and this can be pushed into the sediment in order to make a long vertical measurement of the C-free concentration. And finally, here's a system that Upal, who's going to speak next, developed using POM. You can see the POM in this upper right-hand corner. And here he's put the POM inside a stainless steel mesh, attached that to a brick, and then you can put that on the bottom of your aquatic system and get a sediment-water interface measurement or collection. And again, just another cartoon showing what these samplers look like when deployed. I just want to note that you may need divers to deploy some of these types of passive samplers in sediments. Here's a photograph of Phil Geschwind at the United Heckathorn Superfund site handing one of his samplers to a diver. And the EPA's Osrati and Region 10 dive teams have a great deal of experience using passive samplers and deploying them, recovering them, and so they may be a resource to some people, or at least, you know, can provide some advice on how to proceed. Finally, for this section, I just wanted to show an image or two of a system we used at the Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund site, looking at pore water and water column concentrations of contaminants. Again, we were comparing different types of samplers, so we had PE and POM in the system, and we also had some SPEMIs that, that Keith provided. And when this system was deployed, and this is a photograph of one of the test dives, we had samplers that were up in the water column, as well as samplers that were in the sediment. So we could get both a measurement of water column C-free and pore water C-free. And what this allowed us to do was to calculate or measure the contaminant flux from the sediments into the water column. And so when Loretta Fernandez was doing this study a couple of years ago, she was able to plot data from one of the stations, and I just put it up on the screen. So we have depth on the y-axis, concentration of C-free, and this is a DDT site, so we were looking at DDE, one of the breakdown products, in nanograms per liter. And you can see the pore water concentration, that's the purple line, and up in the water column, you can see the water column concentration. And based on these measurements, she was able to predict a flux of about 300 nanograms of DDE per centimeter squared per year at the site, at this particular station. Okay, getting close to wrapping it up. Just very quickly on analyzing the data, Keith talked about this. I've already talked about it briefly, but just to, I guess, emphasize it, currently when you have passive samplers analyzed by a lab, an analytical lab, and there are a few around the country who do measure, will measure contaminants in passive samplers, chances are they will come back with just the C sampler concentration, the concentration of contaminants in the sampler. They will not, at this point, probably do C-free, calculate C-free for you. When they report that data, it'll be in various units, nanogram per gram or nanogram per mil, and you can switch between those two as a function of the density of the polymer. That's really not that problematic. You also need a partition coefficient for a given contaminant, and again, I think Upal will talk about that. And when you have those two pieces of information, the C sampler concentration and a partition coefficient, you can then calculate your C-free. So in summary, just want to note that passive sampling provides data on really at least two pieces of information, the C-free concentration, which I've talked about quite a bit, as well as the concentration accumulated by the passive sampler. The approach is based on well-understood principles of equilibrium partitioning and sampling. And finally, the preparation, deployment, recovery, storage are really no more complicated than our current sampling methods. And in fact, because we're actually getting at the C-free concentration with passive samplers, the passive samplers may provide data, scientific data, that's more robust and more useful, may be logistically simpler, and ultimately may be more cost-effective compared to sediment samples or tissue samples that require a lot of cleanup. Passive sampler samples are relatively clean samples. And then finally, just some documents that might be useful. In the upper right-hand corner is a EUCPA ORD and Superfund document that's basically an introduction to passive sampling. The middle document is a EPA ORD document on different approaches for measuring C-free, including using passive samplers. And then the lower document that's shown is one of the papers from the workshop that Keith talked about and that Upal will talk about. So with that, thank you for your attention, and I'll answer any questions I can. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rob. Hopefully folks can hear me. Rob, can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay, great. So we have plenty of time for questions here. I'd like to start actually with the simulcast questions since we didn't get to them last time. And Rob and Keith, I may fire at either one of you, so if you could unmute both of you. Well, first question from here is, and you mentioned that SPMDs aren't used in sediments because of concerns about abrasion. do these other types of samplers have problems with abrasion, loss of material, recoverability?
No, I think, you know, by comparison to SPMDs, they don't.
Is MyPath available on our website? Yeah.
Thanks, Rob. And just a quick reminder there, we're getting some background. If you're not asking a question, please put us on mute.
Oh, that's right.
And the only thing I'd add is with the SPMDs, you do need to put them in some sort of protective, or often you need to put them in some sort of protective casing like a stainless steel or a copper mesh so that they're easier to recover at the end of your deployment.
And then I think another question for you, Rob, is there a, can these samplers be stored indefinitely? Is there a holding time for them?
I don't think there's any definitive research that's addressed that so far, you know, like a time series that's gone on for years and years and years. But I think most of the data so far that people have found at research laboratories is that you, as long as they're frozen at negative 4 degrees C, they can be stored indefinitely. But it certainly would be helpful that if at some point one of those, a long-term study was done to confirm that. But so far it looks pretty positive.
Sounds good. Well, let's go to the phone lines here. Go ahead, and if you have a question on the phone lines, unmute. And again, that's #6 to unmute, *6 to remute.
This is Jim Honenberg. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
I have a question. Has there been statistical evaluations of how concentrations found in the passive samplers relate to ag and fish or other biota?
There have been several research studies, you know, probably on the order of 10, 11, 12 published studies that have done that sort of comparison. And you tend to see two trends. One is that you get essentially a one-to-one relationship. That is, whatever is, say you're looking at PCBs, the concentration of PCBs that's accumulated in the passive sampler is identical or very similar to the concentration in the lipids of whatever organism you're looking at. So that's one trend. The second trend is the concentration in the lipids of the organisms are about an order of magnitude higher than what you see in the passive sampler. And that's one of the research questions is, why is that happening? Because if we assume that the lipid and the polymer behave in a relatively similar way, we would expect a one-to-one relationship in most cases. And sometimes, as I say, you don't see that. So that's a research area. But I can't give you a proportion that half the time you get a one-to-one relationship and the other half you don't. But, you know, so far it has looked very promising that the passive samplers do serve or behave like a surrogate for organismal bioaccumulation.
Is that relationship consistent from one organism to the next?
Well, the range of animals that have been looked at have been mussel data, blue mussels, polychaetes, some amphipod species, both freshwater and saltwater. I mean, there isn't a tremendous data set, so it's hard to generalize, but so far with the species that have been looked at, it's been pretty positive.
About
and I should I'm not familiar with much with data on fish doing that sort of, the sort of comparison you're describing. But, you know, depending on the species, I'm not sure we would expect there to be a one-to-one relationship because, you know, with fish, you're going to start having food chain effects. You know, the fish is not just interacting with the sediment. It's interacting with other sources of contaminants. And as we know, the fish swim all over the place, so they're getting exposed to PCBs or whatever the contaminant is from multiple sources. So I think the fish, especially water column fish, it's more complicated than with a polyketone or with a stationary muscle.
Okay, thank you.
And I should say the relationships are, in all of the data that I've seen anyway, are linear. There's a nice linear significant relationship. It's just not always one-to-one.
Thanks, Rob. And I'll fire off another question from the simulcast, and I think this one goes back to Keith's talk. So Keith, could you expand on which of the organic compounds out there have we're pretty certain about the K-values for passive samplers versus other compounds where maybe there's more work needed?
So sure, thanks for the question. For your garden variety PCBs, I think we have an excellent universal correlation, and basically that's how the workshop folks agreed to publish K values as a correlational relationship between the K value and the KOW of a given PCB. Those can all be found, those relationships can be found in those publications. I would say for PAHs, we probably have a little more uncertainty in the K values, and that is true across the different phases. In other words, the polyethylene, the SPME silicone material, as well as the POM. We also have values for the various organochlorines, DDTs, and chlordanes, and I would say that they all fit into that same boat. The uncertainty that we've identified for these K values is about a 0.2 log unit value. So we're pretty confident in that band. Any value that you might want to use that lies outside of that band of our correlations, you probably want to scrutinize very carefully.
Thanks, Keith. And well, since I've got you here, you know, one of the questions directed at you was, could you explain why laboratory measurements are worst-case measurements compared to field measurements? And you know, are you saying that the lab measurements lead you to higher concentrations?
We're thinking that these are worst-case measurements because in the lab, you're basically doing everything you can to achieve full equilibrium. In other words, you're trying to establish equilibrium in an accelerated sense. So you're really spinning or agitating that sediment, which you obviously don't do in the field, at least not in that sense of, you know, putting it on a shaker table or whatnot. And so, again, the feeling is that doing such manipulation in the lab will release the maximum amount possible of contaminant into that pore water, which will be taken up by the sampler in your jar or vial. In the field, you're going to have conditions that may vary in terms of the hydrogeology and the flow of the pore water in the subsurface environment. In many of those cases, you may not reach equilibrium, and so now you're reliant on either estimating your fractional equilibrium or, again, just assuming that you have reached equilibrium. In that sense, you're probably overestimating your C-free a little bit, but we don't see that as being more than you can achieve in the lab.
Sounds good. Thanks, Keith. And I think, you know, we've got maybe time for one question from the phone. So anyone on the phone lines want to chime in? Okay. Well, I see plenty of questions coming in. These are great, and we will get to as many as we can following our next Q&A session. So with that, I'd like to introduce our final speaker for the day. Our third presentation today is from Dr. Paul Ghosh. Dr. Ghosh has a master's and a PhD in civil environmental engineering from the State University of New York at Buffalo. He worked as a postdoctoral associate at Carnegie Mellon University and as a research associate at Stanford University before starting his faculty career at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. His group performs research in environmental engineering and science with a focus on the fate, effects, and remediation of toxic pollutants in the environment. They use multidisciplinary tools to investigate exposure and bioavailability of organic and metal contaminants to organisms. And this new understanding is used to develop novel remediation technologies, site-specific remediation goals. Recent projects have focused on contaminants such as PCBs, PAHs, pesticides, dioxins, and mercury. And with that, Dr. Ghosh. And you may have to unmute your phone line again. That is #6.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, yes, we can. So.
Okay. That's Thanks. Great. Good afternoon, everyone, and maybe morning or night for some people who have called in from elsewhere. Thank you all for listening in. And I'm going to focus on the practical guidance that we developed as a consensus among several researchers and practitioners that came together as part of a workshop that was held a couple of years ago that Keith and Rob mentioned in their talks. So I'll quickly go on to the next slide here, give a quick outline. So I'm going to talk about the practical guidance, talk about polymer types and basis for the sampler calibration, and some of these issues that are listed here, which is basically a snapshot of what's in there in the paper published in IEAM earlier this year. And I'm also going to end with a few examples that might address one of the questions that came up at the end of the last talk in terms of looking at how useful C-free measurement is in predicting uptake in benthic organisms or uptake in fish, which is some of our latest studies funded by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, the Superfund Research Program. So this is a paper that I just mentioned and others mentioned, which has some of the details on practical guidance, selection, and calibration, has some of the consensus values that we have come up with at this time for PCBs and PAHs in three different polymers. So here in this slide explains some of the basis of how the passive sampling works. And the question came up in the, at the end of the first talk in terms of the relevance of the freely dissolved concentrations versus pollutants that might be associated with the dissolved carbon or the particulate organic carbon in sediments. And that's a really good question. And the issue with strongly hydrophobic chemicals like PAHs or DDT or PCBs is that these are being very hydrophobic. They tend to associate with organic materials in sediments and in the pore water that's suspended or in a colloidal state. And the freely dissolved component is probably a small fraction of the total that one might measure if one were to take a liter of water sample or pore water sample and extract and measure what's in there in terms of PCBs or DDT. Now, several studies have shown that for organisms that are exposed to, say, the sediment or the overlying water, the negative effects that we are concerned about from these chemicals, which could be either direct toxicity to these organisms or bioaccumulation in this organism, which then gets passed on to higher levels in the food chain, is dictated by what the freely dissolved concentration is in the medium. And there are several studies for organics and also for metals that show that toxicities that are determined for organisms for water-only exposures can be used to assess the toxicity for those same toxic chemicals, metals or organics, in a sediment environment if the freely dissolved concentration is used as the metric of exposure. And what that tells us is that at equilibrium, it doesn't matter if we take that little box on the top right, if we fill that up with sediment with only a small amount of pore water, the accumulation in the organism or the toxic effect in the organism is really going to be dependent on how much freely dissolved concentration is present. Now, the organism could be exchanging with the different phases, could be feeding on the DOC or the POC and getting its exposure from those components. But at equilibrium, the partitioning between the organism phase and the freely dissolved phase is conserved. So that's kind of the basis of this idea of using freely dissolved concentrations to get a better prediction of what the toxic effects would be or the bioaccumulation would be in the organism. It's not to say that the freely dissolved concentration is the only medium of exposure to the organism. The organism could be feeding on the sediments, but still, at equilibrium, the lipid concentrations would partition with the freely dissolved concentration with a very well-defined partitioning constant. So the challenge for us is to measure these freely dissolved concentrations, and in the past we have tried to get to it in a roundabout way. And one of the ways is to measure the total concentration in the water phase and then subtract out by some kind of a calculation of what may be associated with the DOC and the POC. That can be done if we know, if we can accurately determine what the component of what the concentrations of DOC and POC are, and what the partitioning of that chemical is to the DOC or the POC as given in that equation out there. And the challenge is that the DOC and the POC vary from site to site. So it's not, its properties are not conserved from between sites. And so we have this problem of trying to estimate a very small quantity, which is C-free, from the difference of two large quantities, which is C-total and what's associated with all these non-dissolved phases. And that brings in a lot of uncertainty in the measurement if we go that way. So the alternate way that we have, we are very excited about, that seems to be working for a lot of contaminants, is that instead of doing this indirect measurement of freely dissolved concentration, if we can introduce into that box that's in that slide a very well-characterized medium which has properties of sorption similar to the organic carbon in sediments, but it's a polymer. So if it's a polymer like polyethylene, we can produce multiple quantities of that which has exactly the same properties. So we know exactly what the partition constant is with that polymeric material. And if we allow it to come to equilibrium with the sediment or the water that we're trying to measure, we can then by knowing the partition constant and by knowing what's accumulated in that sampler at equilibrium, we can back out the freely dissolved concentration if it comes to equilibrium. And we looked at some of those examples in the last couple of slides. So one of the key elements of this to work out in a very simple way with just partitioning is that the sampler achieves equilibrium. But we know that when we put a sampler in, a polymeric material into a sediment matrix or in water, there is it takes a while to reach equilibrium. The data points shown here are actually for a tetrachlorobiphenyl absorbing into a polyoxymethylene passive sampler in a batch equilibrium mode. So there is a period of time that the kinetics play a important role, and the concentration builds up within the polymer. But if you look at the data there, maybe after 10 or 15 days, we achieve a steady state concentration within the polymer, which would be the equilibrium concentration within the polymer. Now, if we allow the polymer to achieve that equilibrium, then the calculation of pore water concentration is trivial. However, if you are in the kinetic mode, which is in the shaded blue shaded portion of the curve, then we have to do some kind of a correction, which involves knowing how far we are towards equilibrium. And that's where some of the challenges are in measurement, especially when the measurement is done in the field and not in the lab. Because in the lab, we can mix up into a slurry the sediment and the water and the polymer, and enhance that mass transfer rate. And we know for certain ranges of hydrophobicities of compounds and thicknesses of polymers that if we do that mixing for 2 weeks or 4 weeks, we achieve equilibrium. However, in the field, if we insert a polymer in the sediment phase, we may not reach that equilibrium. And that's where non-equilibrium corrections come in. And there are several ways to correct for the non-equilibrium. Several types of assumptions go into those calculations. And the basic message is that if we are close enough to equilibrium, these corrections work great. But if you are far from equilibrium, where you have to do a lot of correction to achieve that equilibrium value, then the error bars associated with that becomes large. So, and the potential challenge here is that the way we normally do these non-equilibrium corrections is by introducing reference compounds. These are typically deuterated compounds or compounds that are not present in the native sediments. And then we introduce them along with the polymer and look at how these reference compounds are released from the polymer during that exposure period. And from that, we can back out the kinetics of absorption into the polymer. And the challenge is that we can only do it for a few congeners of, say, PCBs or few deuterated PAHs. And then we have to interpret the behavior of a large range of PAHs or PCBs in terms of how they equilibrate within that polymer. It can be done, and the corrections work great if the polymer is already maybe halfway to equilibrium. But if it is, say, 20% to equilibrium, then those corrections become a little more challenging. In this slide, we talk about selection considerations for passive sampling devices. So if we are thinking of doing passive sampling measurement for a given contaminant, there are certain things that come into play in deciding what type of passive samplers one might use. So identity of the target contaminant is an important one. For example, if we know it's a PCB, we know that we can use any of those three types of passive samplers that Rob talked about because we have the partition constants that people have calculated for these polymers. However, if we have a unique compound, say, for example, compounds like dioxins, which have not been experimented much in the passive sampling world, there is limited partitioning data that's available, and that may be for a certain type of polymer. One of the considerations is with field deployments is accessibility and conditions for the site. So, for example, depending on the water depth, one might be able to wade in and push a sampler in, or might have to use divers like Rob showed, which would need a more involved logistics of the application and cost as well. If the sediment is soft, it's easy to insert materials or insert probes. However, hard benthic substrates may be more difficult to penetrate through. One might need more mechanical devices to be able to get to the depth that one is interested in. Sampler design characteristics, so we need to, depending on what the detection limits are that we are targeting, one may have to determine what the polymer volume is. One would like to use thinner polymers as possible, as thin as possible to achieve equilibrium more quickly. Thicker the polymer, longer it takes to equilibrate in the field. One has to think about potential disturbance or damage that could be caused in that particular environment to the polymer. And depending on the type of polymer, one might need to encase it in some kind of a device which allows water exchange or pore water exchange, but gives some kind of structural rigidity to the polymeric material, especially if it has to be inserted into a hard substrate or a sediment environment. There are also considerations that have to be given in terms of if non-equilibrium conditions have to be dealt with, then one has to allow one has to use the right kind of performance reference compounds that have to be added on to that polymer. Cost is an important issue. There are some differences in cost depending on the polymers, but most of the cost ends up being really associated with either the deployment activity in the field. If the logistics is challenging, then that increases the cost. and chemical analysis and the cost of the performance reference compounds. If a large number of deuterated compounds have to be used, they tend to be a little more expensive. Field deployments are useful in looking at concentration profiles with depth, or also spatial extent and profiles of concentrations. And if that's of importance, then one has to do some kind of a field measurement which captures the native variability in the field, and also some of the variability that may be associated with temporal changes in the site. This is a snapshot of polymer partition constants that's presented in that IEAM paper that we talked about. This is Ghosh et al. 2014. And these partition constants that have been determined for PHs and PCBs for the three commonly used polymers, PDMS, polyethylene, and polyoxymethylene, are presented here as correlation with the log KOW of the compound. So one would use for PCBs that particular equation for the PCB and use the log KOW to calculate the log KPE, for example. And if you look at the little plot there on the right bottom, the partition constant, which is on the y-axis, the log, so that's log KPSM on the y-axis, plotted against log KOW on the x-axis. And if you look at these plots, they kind of overlap. They're all within about an order of magnitude, but for the hydrophobicity compounds, you can see that the polyethylene probably absorbs a little more than POM, and POM absorbs a little more than PDMS. So you would, for the same mass deployment of these polymers, you'll probably pick up the most in PE and the least in PDMS. So that could be an important criteria when selecting polymers, especially when very low detection limits are being sought. There are ways to correct for temperature and salinity. These corrections tend to be small, but there are methods that are indicated in that paper that can be used to make those small corrections that one may need to do for temperature and salinity. These KP, the partition constants are calculated for fresh water at room temperature. And if your field condition is saline and temperature is low or high, there are small corrections that might need to be performed. But there are standard ways to do that, which is discussed in that paper. One of the important considerations that come in is ex situ versus in situ deployments, and there are pros and cons associated with each of them. We talked about that a lot in that workshop, and the paper discusses some of these issues. So here, in a nutshell, some of the considerations that go into deciding whether to do the measurement in situ or ex situ. It's easier to achieve and confirm equilibrium in the lab. So that way, measurement in the lab in a well-mixed system gives you a certain level of certainty in, and it's easier to do the measurements. But if spatial scale and differences across spatial locations within the site is important, that has to be performed in situ. There are issues with contaminant depletion that happens if polymers are inserted in situ without significant movement of the pore water. That can be addressed, that need to be addressed with performance reference compounds, so that depletion, local depletion around the polymer, doesn't give an erroneous value in terms of pore water concentrations. Statistical design can be an important criteria. Multiple treatments and replication is possible in the lab, whereas replication in the field gets challenging if there is a lot of small-scale heterogeneity of the concentration of chemicals in the site, or properties of sediments across the site. Ease of implementation, of course, lab implementation is very easy compared to doing it in the field, especially if polymers, passive samplers have to be deployed in deep water conditions. However, if it is important to capture field conditions, then one has to be able to do these measurements in situ in the field. There are several important aspects of passive sampler preparation and processing that one needs to keep in mind, and These include cleaning up the passive sampler to remove any contaminant that may be present in it, and one may need to add in performance reference compounds. There are standard methods available to do that. The samplers may need to be mounted in some form to allow water exposure while providing rigidity that's needed for the kind of deployment that's intended. It's important to make sure that the polymer sheets do not fold up, and that has resulted in the past in some of the early studies inconsistencies in measurement. So the polymer folds up onto itself, then the mass transfer is slowed down, and so one would need to make sure that these polymers are exposed from all sides to water in the field and to allow maximum exchange with the water phase. Upon retrieval, it's important to remove debris. You might get deposits of clay. It could get biofilms forming on it, and those need to be removed before the sampler is analyzed for PCBs or PAHs or whatever the contaminant is. One needs to make an accurate weight measurement of the polymer. It is often possible that if it is a water exposure deployment in the field, pieces of polymer get torn off. You can get animals come and grab at it. So the actual weight of the polymer after retrieval is important to measure to associate it with the concentration that has been measured from the extract from that polymer. Yeah, the polymers are extracted and need to be extracted in an appropriate solvent. There are different types of solvents that work well for the different polymers. And one needs to use surrogates to make sure that the extraction is working out well. And field blanks need to be analyzed for exposure during transport and handling. This can be especially important for some of the low molecular weight PAHs, which could be present in the atmosphere or in the lab and can confound measurements that have been done in the field. One of the great things about passive samplers is it has allowed us to push the detection limits to really, really low concentrations. For an example here, what's shown here is detection limits for a few polychlorinated biphenyls using polyoxymethylene. And you can see that even with 0.2 grams of polyoxymethylene deployed, the detection limits are well down to close to a picogram per liter, except for the PCB3, which is a less chlorinated, less hydrophobic compound, which partitions less to the polymer. With that, I was going to spend a few minutes talking about some of the examples of use of passive samplers in the field, some of the work that we do. The picture on the left bottom is lab batch equilibrium studies, which can be used to derive site-specific partition constants for sediments for a given site, which allows better risk assessment for the site. We also use these in field deployments, either for overlying water concentrations or with looking at differences between overlying water and sediment pore water to understand flux, like you heard in one of the earlier talks. Addressing one of the questions that came up earlier, how much confidence we have in terms of looking at using freely dissolved concentrations in pore water to predict uptake in benthic organisms. So there are two kinds of studies that have been done looking at effects of toxicity and effects of bioaccumulation, and relating those to directly measured pore water concentrations in sediments for PAHs or PCBs. So much of the work on toxicity has been done looking at narcosis to benthic organisms from PAHs in sediments, and there's really very nice studies that have been performed that show that if instead of total sediment concentrations, one looks at pore water concentrations or PAHs, one gets a much better prediction of which sediments are toxic to benthic organisms and which are not. I show here a study that we did a few years ago and published in ESNT Warner et al. 2010, where we looked at results from our studies from seven freshwater and marine sediments with different organisms, mostly clams or some kind of oligochaete or worm, and correlating, looking at estimated lipid concentrations in those experimental measurements to measured lipid concentrations. And if we do the predictions from sediment concentrations, we are off by about an order of magnitude or more in the prediction of lipids in the concentrations in the lipids in the organism. However, if we use the directly measured pore water concentration C-free and use that along with a correlation between aqueous concentration and lipid concentrations and predict the concentration in lipids in these seven freshwater and marine sediments, we get a much tighter prediction when we go from pore water to lipid concentrations in these organisms. So this is with respect to benthic organisms, and we are able to do a much better job of prediction using C-free than with total sediments. We're also interested in looking at uptake in fish, and that takes me to the Superfund Research Program-funded project that we are doing in our labs, looking at the ability of freely dissolved concentrations measured in the overlying water and pore water and incorporating them into food chain models to predict uptake in fish. And as Rob mentioned, that with fish, one has to account for uptake pathways into fish through its diet, and that's important. And we do that, and when we look at how the fish responds in different kinds of environments where we change bioavailability in sediments. So this is where we look at contaminant sediments and contaminant sediments where the pore water concentrations have been suppressed by the addition of activated carbon, which acts as a strong adsorbent in the sediment phase, reducing the pore water concentrations, reducing the flux into the overlying water. So in these experimental studies with a very simplified ecosystem where we have sediments, we have fish, we have passive samplers in the overlying water, passive samplers in the sediment, and we are using those measurements to try and predict what's taken up by the fish over time. We see how the pore water concentrations are, what's shown here in this slide is that if we reduce the bioavailability of the PCBs in sediments, we see a big reduction in the pore water concentrations, we see a big reduction in the overlying water concentrations associated with those sediments that have been treated with activated carbon. And when we look at what's taken up by the fish in these experimental aquaria, compare it to fish that have been exposed in the untreated tanks and the treated tanks, we see a big difference, 87% reduction in the uptake in the fish lipids when those sediments have been treated with carbon to reduce bioavailability. And then we look at ability to model uptake into the fish. And in this case, the fish was fed with PCB-free diet, but the fish was exposed to the water in the aquaria where we had the different types of treated or untreated sediments. And there are two ways one can model it. One can model it by looking at partitioning between the fish lipids and the aqueous phase in the overlying water, assuming that the fish is acting as a passive sampler in the water column, or we can look at the kinetic approach, which accounts for uptake through the gill, depuration on the fish, and in this case, the feeding, which is PCB-free diet that the fish were fed. And if you look at equilibrium versus the kinetic models, both of those models have reasonably well, predict reasonably well the observed concentrations in the fish. The kinetic model does a little better, which is shown on the right, and what's shown here in the two different colors is untreated sediment, which generally shows higher accumulation and also higher predicted accumulation in the fish, and the blue dots are the treated sediments where the our observed concentrations in the fish were lower, and also the predicted concentrations were lower because we are predicting based on the reduced pore water concentrations. With that, some of the key conclusions, by following this guidance that I mentioned earlier in the talk, it's possible to use passive sampling methods for contaminant sediment site assessments, and the use of passive sampling methods require involvement of personnel familiar with the science. So there are a few issues that we mentioned, for example, reaching equilibrium, making the performing the calculation either for an equilibrium case or for a non-equilibrium case, which requires the involvement of personnel who are familiar with the science or at least are familiar with some of the methods that have been outlined in the series of papers that are available now. Some of the recommendations going forward, and some of these are already being carried out. We need more interlab tests for greater confidence in the precision. We just finished participating in an interlab study with various polymers. There are about 7 or 8 labs that participated in that, and those results should be coming out in the next year. We also need to develop standard reference materials to check method accuracy. We still don't have that for passive sampling measurements. Individual labs have their own ways to try to confirm that these measurements are working out well. We also need more development on the non-equilibrium passive sampling methods in the field and the further validation of the use of performance reference compounds in static sediments, and more organic compounds with known passive sampler water partition constants. We have a good data set for PCBs, PAHs, but as you go into some of the pesticides and some of the other compounds that are of importance for risk assessments, it starts getting thinner and thinner in terms of the amount of data, validated data that are available for doing these calculations for pore water concentrations. And with that, I would end with an acknowledgement from support that we have received in some of the work that we have done in passive sampling from the DoD CERTA PACCP programs, the NIEHS Superfund research program, some of the early work that we did with US EPA, Glenpo support, and Alcoa, and graduate students at UMBC who carried out a lot of the work. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. And we do have plenty of time left for questions. I see several questions here asking about the documents that we've been referring to from the CTAC work group. And so just to point folks to where you can find them, on your Adobe Connect page, you should see a related URL pod. And there, within there is a link called Seminar Resources. And that link should take you to PDF copies of these. They are open source papers, so everyone, they're easily accessed. And with that, let's open it up to the phone lines. Anyone on the phone have a question for Dr. Ghosh?
Yes, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
This is Dan Lavoie. I work at CH2M Hill, and I have a question that kind of overlaps all three talks with respect to the kinetics and also just the logistical and practical application. And it's with respect to in situ exposures in pore water. We've been doing a lot of pore water sampling where we do groundwater, surface water investigation, but there's been a lot of overlap. When you're working with the sediments, there's the questions have come up about bioavailability and bioaccumulation. And so we use a device often like a modified piezometer that creates sort of a reservoir of the pore water environment. And my question is, do you lose when you're applying some of these tools? I noticed the setup for some of the devices have direct contact with the sediment, where the sediment is actually touching the passive sampling device. Do you lose anything if you're using sort of like a peeper or a pore water reservoir with respect to the uptake and bioaccumulation, and wondered if you guys have used those devices for your studies?
Well, I can try to address that. Some of these devices that have been used to give the mechanical strength to allow insertion of some of these polymers are like peepers. I think I'm getting a feedback. I'm not sure exactly why. But one of the issues is that if there is a thick body of free water around a passive sampler and no sediment, it reduces the rate at which the exchange would happen. For these passive samplers deployed in the sediment, much of the mass transfer resistance is really on the sediment side and not on the polymer side. And having a body of water around the passive sampler within the peeper and not sediment increases the distance that molecules have to travel to reach the polymer. So in that sense, I would think that it would slow down the mass transfer into the polymer if the polymer is made to be further away from close contact with the sediment. Rob, do you want to add anything to that?
No, Upal, I agree. And I guess I'm assuming that the sampler, that the water is not isolated from the sediment. I guess what I'm trying to get at is you want to avoid depletion, that if you just have the water with the contaminants in it and you have your sampler, the sampler is going to deplete that volume of water of the contaminants, and it may give you an artificial C-free concentration if the sediment is somehow physically separated from that volume of water. I mean, as long as the sediment does have contact to that volume of water that is being sampled, it seems as though it's okay, except for the kinetic issues that Upal just went through. And I guess one more thing I'd mention, you know, we're not talking about metals today, but in terms of sampling the C-free concentration for metals, peepers are probably one of the better tools we have currently. We don't really have a great polymer at this point for passive sampling metals, so we often fall back on peepers.
Thank you all. And we got a similar question online, so we'll go to that one. I don't know how similar it actually is, but have any of these passive samplers been used for groundwater? And in particular, the questioner is asking regarding PCBs in groundwater monitoring. Yep.
Well, I'm not aware of use in groundwater monitoring for PCBs, but we do routinely use it to measure pore water in sediments maybe a few feet deep under the sediment surface. So if that's considered groundwater, yes, there is evidence, there is a lot of experience measuring it. But I myself have not done any measurement in a real aquifer. Others may have.
You know, I know that Carl Gustafson, who gave one of the presentations in the first set of presentations in this series, he has a publication from the early 2000s where I believe he used an SPMD and tried to make groundwater measurements with that. But that's the only study I'm aware of where people have tried to use passive samplers in a groundwater system.
And I am aware of other types of passive samplers used for groundwater, but they generally target more soluble compounds. So, okay. Thanks. Do we
have
anyone
else on the
phone?
Hello?
We can hear you.
Okay, this is Ken Finkelstein once more, and I hate to be the harbinger of bad news here, but I'm not sure I'm getting... I am getting it. I'm not sure I'm believing it. And I think it might be just simply a chemist, biologist rift here, because I've done some work with the C-free now, and as I said before, I'm coming up with a KOC of about 7.5, whereas, you know, the KOW, the KOC numbers, as we talked about earlier, give you a much lower number. And what I'm finding in my work is, and this is through equilibrium partitioning, looking at injury to the benthic organisms via the aquatic database, is that I get about 20% injury for about one part per million of PCBs. Once I throw in the KOC of using the C-free, it turns into about 750 parts per million for 20% injury. That's how different the two models are. And I don't think there's anybody on the line that's going to say, you know, we should clean up our PCB sites to about 750 parts per million. So something's not working here, and I can't quite grasp it. It seems like I'm on two ends of a spectrum that neither one are very satisfactory. But certainly go ahead, you go ahead, please.
Let me try to address this. Is this 20% injury to benthic organisms or higher up in the food chain effects?
Benthic organisms.
Okay. So I think you bring up a very interesting point here for PCBs, that it may be that when for some sediments, that for benthic organism toxicity, a higher level of PCB would be okay. But it's not going to be okay for the bald eagles. Because if we really take that 1 ppm PCB in sediments and translate that to a food chain into concentrations in bald eagles, they'll probably not survive. So if I understand it right, and maybe Rob needs to say what he thinks about it, is that for PCBs, the negative effects really manifest higher up in the food chain, not so much in the benthic organisms. So benthic organisms, and that's one of the problems. If the benthic organisms were seeing the acute toxicity from PCBs, then we would be wiping out these benthic organisms in sites where we have PCBs, and actually our higher organisms like bald eagles would be actually safe. And the reason we have accumulation higher up in the food chain with PCBs and DDT is that the benthic organisms are actually doing fine. And so they end up accumulating and sending these PCBs up the food chain into higher levels of the trophic chain, where we end up seeing these negative effects. Did that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. It is an interesting way of looking at this. I do want to point out one more thing, that I'm giving this poster at the Battelle Conference in New Orleans, if anybody wants to come over and yell at me some. No gunplay, though, right?
Ken, this is Rob. What are you looking at, a specific PCB congener, or are you looking at a group of PCBs?
I'm looking at Araclor 1254. And the way I got the 7.5 is I took the work that Steve Hawthorne has done, and he provides congeners for individual – I'm sorry, he finds KOCs for individual congeners, and then I averaged them out per homolog, and then there's an ATSDR document that tells you what the percentage of each homolog goes into 1254, and it comes out to about 7.5. And then what I used as a database was the aquatic database showing PCB aquatic values versus benthic organism impacts injury. And then I transformed those using EQP into a sediment number. And then I used a PRISM. It's called PRISM. It's basically, you know, a statistical database to give me a dose response for each basically, the dose response giving you a percentage of injury per PCB concentration. So I hope that you understood that. But it's a dose response curve using moving from the aquatic database to the sediment database.
Okay. Yeah.
Of course, the whole thing is based on your KOC. Everything is based on KOC, and whichever one you throw in, you know, you're not happy with.
Mm. Okay, and so the KOC you're using is something you took from Steve Hawthorne's paper.
The actual KOC I used for the model was from the EPA EpiWin document, if you're familiar with that.
Okay.
EpiWin 4.1, which gives me 4.8. So where I got the 7.5 was from Steve Hawthorne's work, where he uses C-free, and he... comes up with the LFER database. He gives you a KOC per congener, and of course he doesn't have all the congeners, so you have to average the congeners per homolog, and then multiply the percentage of the homolog into 1254. It's kind of a roundabout, but it's quite simple.
This is Matt. I think this is getting kind of into details here. Why don't we take this conversation offline and we can...
I think you're right. But you could see it at the Battelle, okay? All right.
That sounds good.
And I apologize.
I'll stop by.
And I apologize that I spoke so much longer than everyone else.
Not at all. Right, we've got a few more minutes here for final questions, and then we'll kind of go through what the other resources are available to you at the end of the talk here. Some of the questions coming in online have to do with deployment logistics. One of these is, how do you deal with surface deposits, biofouling, that kind of thing? How might they confound the results? So kind of the analytical QAQC stuff for deployments.
I'll take a first shot at this. One of the topics that we, because of time limitations, we didn't really get to talk about are the PRCs. Upal talked about them to a certain extent in his talk. But PRCs, these performance reference compounds, that is one approach that you can use to address deposits that occur on your samplers, because without going into a lot of detail, the PRCs basically face the same sorts of growth and hindrances that your target compounds are going to address or are going to face. And so if you have PRCs loaded into your samplers, you can use that data and that information to basically subtract out the effects of surface deposits and growth on your sampler. But unfortunately, as I said, it's kind of a complicated topic, and it would take more time to describe.
Okay. Thanks, Rob. Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
No, Rob addressed it well. I would also add to it that there are two ways that the surface deposits are falling impact. One is what Rob mentioned, which is changes the kinetics of how the compounds go into the polymer. But also it can confound the measurement if these materials are not removed from the polymer before they are extracted and measured. So the guidance is that anything extraneous attached to the polymer have to be removed, cleaned, before the polymer is extracted and measured.
Good point.
Okay, and then I think just time for one last question here, and I should note we will record all the questions in the queue right now and send them to the speakers, and we'll post their response on our website associated with this talk, so you can look at those afterwards. I guess the last question we'll choose here is, what are some of the common sources of uncertainty when you're measuring C-free from passive samplers? And this is for any of the instructors.
Well, I can give my list here. Number one would be the equilibrium versus non-equilibrium. The second is the uncertainty associated with the K polymer value. There's a small amount of uncertainty there. Those are the two primary ones I would suggest. Maybe Rob and Keith have other uncertainties they would like to talk about.
This is Rob. Yeah, I agree with Upal. Those are the two big ones. And in Upal's presentation, he went through some other sources as well. And in the paper that he's the first author on from that came out of the CTAC workshop, he lists several others to be concerned about. But the two big ones are the whether or not you're at equilibrium and the how much faith you have in your partition coefficients.
Yeah, I'll just echo that. That's why we provided the guidance. If you're obtaining K values from a separate reference, just be very careful that they line up with the consensus relationships that we compiled.
Okay, and with that, by my watch, that brings us to 4:00. So thank you to all of our instructors for the talks today and for the Q&A sessions. I really appreciate you, all the work you've put into this. We drew everyone's attention earlier to the seminar resources link under your related URL pods. I'd also like to draw your attention to the seminar links, and we do look at those, so please give us your feedback. And as I mentioned, we will any questions on the queue, we'll forward to our instructors and get some responses and have those posted soon. A couple more announcements. There are two more sessions in this series. Session 3, occurring on December 1st from 12:30 to 2:30 East Coast time, is on metals and poor water sampling methods. Session 4 is case studies on passive sampling devices for organic contaminants, and that will be December 15th from 12:30 to 2:30. For more information, go to the SRP Risk E-Learning webpage, and you can sign up with them on their webpage for their Twitter feed at SRP_NIEHS. And with that, thank you everybody for coming, and have a nice day.